Welcome to the Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Sally Higginbottom, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Barbara Noble, a GP in Wolverhampton. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, Sally.
Today we're talking about sepsis, and this is based on the NICE guidance from last year, which has received quite a lot of coverage. Why do you think sepsis is such a hot topic at the moment?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for it. The first is, and it's very sadly, there have been some high-profile deaths because of sepsis. And in retrospect, people have been able to identify areas where maybe the care wasn't as good as it could have been. And also because sepsis is associated with just so many deaths. Apparently it's responsible for about 44,000 deaths per year, and more deaths from sepsis than people who have breast, bowel and prostate cancer combined.
So it's a lot of deaths, and some of them are sudden and potentially avoidable, seems to be the big message. I'm always wondering when I hear those figures, what proportion of those deaths are in hospitalised sick patients in whom our input is unlikely to change their management? Do they ever break down the figures to look at that side of things?
They didn't look at that at all. Overall, the mortality from sepsis is 30%. And you're absolutely right. You know, a lot of the cases are in very ill patients that really nothing could be done about them. But the National Confidential Inquiry into Patient Outcome and Death, just say sepsis, found that there was room for improvement in 39% of the cases where primary care had been involved. Because GPs, you know, there still is quite a bit that we can do.
That's really good to know. So this does affect our patient group. So let's start at the beginning. How would you define sepsis?
It's a life-threatening condition that arises when the body's response to infection sort of injures its own tissues and organs, really.
And when I was younger, we used to talk about septic shock. Is that something different, or are we talking about the same thing with different language now?
No, I think that's the consequence of sepsis. Septic shock is a life-threatening condition when you've got low BP, despite the fact you might have given fluids, and organ failure as well.
So it's the consequence of the sepsis sort of syndrome.
I think it's like a lot of things, that it's easy enough to recognise septic shock, but you have to recognise sepsis to stop the septic shock developing.
Great. So we're trying to avoid getting to that point. So who is particularly at risk?
Well, like a lot of things, it's the very old and the very young.
Okay. So if we think about the very young, the ones that always scare me are the neonates, when someone brings in a very little baby to the surgery. Is that a group we're thinking particularly about with sepsis?
Yes, certainly. The sort of thing to look for in the very young is have a look at the mother's notes. You know, did they have a beta hemolytic strep infection in pregnancy or previously? Did they have ruptured membranes for a long time? Any fever during pregnancy at all? Did the mother have antibiotics for any reason during the pregnancy? And also, in a twin pregnancy or multiple birth, if one baby's ill, it's a possibility that the other one might become ill.
Oh, that's worth thinking about, isn't it? Certainly. The elderly are the other group we see a lot of. How do we assess an adult patient for possible sepsis?
History is most important, especially looking at altered mental state at all. And then taking history either from the patient themselves, if they're able to, or their carer. And then examination, pulse, blood pressure, general appearance. History also includes, are they passing as much urine as normal? Things like that.
Yes, I saw the comment around mental state, and that's quite interesting. Not something I'd usually document in patient notes unless there was something obvious. What sort of things do you look for, and what sort of things do you document when you're thinking about mental state?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because if you're already assessing somebody who's got memory problems, it can be sometimes just a subtle difference in them. And I think it's often listening to the carers and relatives that something just isn't quite right with them. They're more confused than normal. They just maybe aren't behaving in the normal way. That sort of thing.
Yes, I think that's going to be a learning point for me, to be careful to document those sorts of findings. And in children, is there anything particular we're looking out for?
Again, change in behaviour. Are they very sleepy? Are they quite irritable at all? Looking at the skin, any changes in appearance at all? if you've got a Charles Sats meter, is this oxygen saturation low, raised respiratory rate, raised heart rate? It can be fever, but sometimes you can be caught out because not everybody who's septic has a high temperature.
And that's a real problem, isn't it, that is seen sometimes in the learning from events that have gone badly, that we've seen someone without a temperature and assumed that meant they couldn't have sepsis.
Absolutely, yeah.
Would we be looking for a normal temperature in some people with sepsis or even a low temperature? What should we be looking out for?
Temperature over 38 or less than 36 should raise alarm bells.
How about the general appearance of the patient? I often find myself writing in the notes, the patient looked well or the patient looks sick, and on the whole, if the patient looks sick, I'm going to admit them. Is there any validity to my slightly gut reaction to how my patient appears according to the guidance?
I think that's very important, isn't it? Look at the skin. Does it look slightly mottled? Is it ashen? Is there blue tinge to it at all? Also look for rash, of course, an unblanching rash.
But some of these patients are going to have a blanching rash, aren't they? And I think that's another thing that we sometimes are at risk of being falsely reassured, that some people, even with meningococcal sepsis, have a blanching rash initially. This is tricky, isn't it? And I see there's a long list of sort of high-risk symptoms and medium-risk symptoms and traffic-light systems. Is that something you've incorporated into your practice? How do you find that works for you?
The problem with children, for instance, is that what is a normal heart rate for a 3 to 4 year old is quite low for a neonate, for instance. For a neonate's heart rate is much higher than an older child. So I think what helps is to have a list on your wall of what the normal respiratory rate is for a child, the normal heart rate is for a child at various ages, and refer to that all the time.
I find myself doing exactly that, and in my surgery we had it printed on the mouse mat so that everyone's got it in front of them in all the rooms. I find it almost impossible to commit to memory, those sorts of ranges. So yes, keeping an eye on that. But in that long list of symptoms and signs, was there anything that surprised you? Anything that you thought, oh, that's not something I usually look for or would notice?
I think not so much in children, but in older people, is about urine output. That's not something I used to ask about. I do in children, but not in adults, and that it is very important.
So you'd ask when they last went to the toilet over the last 12 hours. How do you do that in practice? Do you have a specific question you like?
Well, it all depends on the patient, really, I think, because if they are somebody who's going to the toilet themselves, that's different to if you've got carers and they may be incontinent. But the carers, if somebody's incontinent, the carers have often noticed that they haven't had to change a pad or something.
Yes, no, that's a good point. And like you, I think I've always been good at documenting the last wet nappy in a baby, but not necessarily thinking about that in someone older. So we've identified this person as having sepsis or potentially having sepsis. What do we do next?
I think we then have to decide if there's any red flags at all.
And what would those be?
If there's been a sudden deterioration in the GCS, in an adult, if the respiratory rate's over 25, if their SATs are down below 92%, a low BP, less than 40 millimetres of mercury below what's normal for them, raised heart rate, loss past urine, non-blanching rash, also especially if they'd had chemotherapy in the last 6 weeks.
So any of those red flags, what do we do next?
Any of those red flags, immediately transfer them to hospital.
And do we give antibiotics, that, or does that depend on your transfer times locally?
I imagine it depends on your transfer times locally. Fortunately, I live in a city, so we're able to get people quickly to hospital.
Yeah.
And I think it's also worthwhile, if you're really worried about somebody, letting A&E know about them as well.
So letting them know they're on their way is often a help. I tend to think of sepsis as a bit of a short-lived event, one of those dramatic things that happened in your duty doctor session. But the module mentions long-term sequelae of sepsis, not something I'd thought much about before. What do you think the GP's role is here?
I think it's sometimes reassurance for the patient, because one of the side effects can be psychological effects. They can be terrified that sepsis is going to recur again. They might have had an awful time in ITU, getting flashbacks to that, and they can get problems with short-term memory loss. They can also get physical problems as well, joint pains, hair loss, and just generally feeling unwell. And I think sometimes reassurance helps.
Yes, and just acknowledgement of these effects as being part of what's happened to them, I guess, could be therapeutic.
Yeah.
But do hospitals follow up these patients to see how they're doing a little while after the event, or are they largely discharged and left to get on with it?
I think it depends on the patient. I think a very elderly patient, I'm sure that it'll be the GP will be looking after them, whereas children would be followed up much more closely.
Yeah. So were there any particular take-home points that have changed your practice and that we haven't mentioned so far from this module?
I think what we need to possibly do is just look a bit more at those patients that are particularly at risk, because we mentioned the very old and the very young, and we've also mentioned patients on chemotherapy. But there's other groups that we need to sort of think about as well. Anybody who's got an impaired immune system, i.e. diabetics, people who've had splenectomies, people with sickle cell disease, anybody on long-term steroids, anybody whose skin has been breached, for instance, if they've had surgery recently, if they've given birth, especially if they've had some sort of invasive procedure when they've given birth. Also, if after they've given birth, if they've had sort of continual vaginal bleeding or vaginal discharge. So people who misuse drugs intravenously.
Because they're all at higher risk of a sepsis event.
Yeah, so I think we do need to mention all those people as well.
That's quite a lot of people, isn't it?
Yes.
My big concern is how many people who are going to meet some of these criteria we're going to be putting in the back of ambulances. Do you feel your practice has changed since this guidance has come out, such that you're referring more patients acutely to A&E, or does it fit with the sort of way you've been doing things in the past?
I don't think I've been referring more people to A&E, but I've been more careful in my assessment of them, especially the elderly in care homes.
That's very interesting.
Taking histories as well, over the phone before visiting.
So you feel it's helped with the assessment in particular, as opposed to changing necessarily your threshold for admission for those same people? That's really helpful. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for listening to this podcast from the RCGP.